It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest says colleges and universities are relying too heavily on part-time or short-term faculty, and it's threatening the mission of higher education. First, we hear a lot about the middle class on the news and in our politics. When we do, it's often because the middle class is shrinking or disappearing even. But our next guest says that by focusing just on the size of the middle class, we're missing a big part of the story. While middle-income groups have gotten smaller in many parts of the world, the reasons for that can be different from place to place. He says understanding those reasons can help us have better public discussions about the middle class and craft more useful policies. Richard Reeves is a senior fellow in economic studies and the director of the Future of the Middle Class Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Richard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, yeah, when we hear talk about the middle class, you've written about this, it's often about the size. How many people are in the middle class? Is it going down? What are we missing only when we talk about, I guess, quantity and not quality?
Well, the main thing we're missing is why there are fewer people in the middle. It depends on how you define it, and I'm sure we'll get into that. But if you're in a situation where there are fewer people in the middle because there are lots of people at the top, in other words, the middle class is shrinking because more people are rich than in the past, that's a very different problem to having a smaller middle class because more people are poor than in the past. And so actually simply saying it's getting smaller doesn't really tell us very much. After all, as countries get richer, fewer and fewer of their citizens would be described as middle class by any global definition. And as the income distribution changes, you're going to see more people in different parts of the distribution. And so the story of the US really is that to the extent that the middle class, by some definitions, not by the ones I prefer to use, but is shrinking, it is largely because there are more people at the top of the income distribution. And so if the middle class is shrinking because more people are rich, then we should be careful, I think, to immediately jump to the conclusion that that's a problem. It might be a problem. It's certainly a problem if you think income inequality is a problem. But it's not immediately obvious that a smaller middle class as a result of a richer population is a bad thing. So we should be clear what we're talking about.
Right. The fear is that the middle class, people in the middle class are slipping. They're maybe at risk of going down, maybe back down to where their grandparents or great-grandparents had been in the lower class. You say that's happening in some parts of the world, maybe even some parts of the United States, but it's not the whole story here.
No, I think that's right. And I think the point you make is that it depends what your benchmark is. Are you comparing yourself to how your parents did or how your grandparents did? Or are you comparing yourself to people maybe living somewhere else in the country? And so, you know, doing well compared to what is a really big question when we're thinking about what's happening to the middle class. But what we're certainly seeing is more income separation. We're seeing those towards the top and those in certain cities and parts of the U.S. doing pretty well. Their incomes are growing quite quickly. And other people in parts of the country where incomes are growing slowly, if at all, and even some where kind of incomes are shrinking. So just to take kind of extreme examples, middle class in Detroit has shrunk, to use that shrinking definition again, as much as the middle class in San Francisco. But the reason for that is because there's a lot more poor people in Detroit now. And the reason that it's shrunk in San Francisco, there's a lot more rich people. So to say that you've got two cities where the middle class has shrunk by the same amount, Detroit and San Francisco, tells us nothing about what's happening in those cities. And so this sort of terminology of shrinking, I think, is really of quite a limited value. And much more important is, look, there's a bunch of people in the middle, depending on how you define it. The question really is, how are they doing? And there, the answer is not as well as they need to be doing.
Now, let's touch on definitions for a minute. You mentioned the question of what is the middle class. I got this bad feeling if I asked 10 economists, I'd get 50 answers. Is there a good working definition?
That's if you're lucky. Yeah, right. There's one. There's a very good volume on the middle class, which I think does have 20 chapters in it, and it uses 48 different definitions of the middle class across those 20 chapters. So you're exactly right. There is no accepted definition of the middle class. The one that is probably most often used, and it's some says that I'm sort of competing with, I guess, from my position, is one that's put out by the Pew Foundation in the US, and it's quite often used elsewhere, which is to peg it to the median, right? So if you take median income, which is somewhere in the 60,000 plus range, right in the middle of the distribution, and then you say, if you've got two-thirds of that, say 50,000, or twice that, say 120,000, if you're between those lines, then you're middle class. So it's pegging it to kind of where's the middle. So the middle is sort of pegged to that. The problem is, first of all, the median can drop quite quickly. But more importantly, it's really there a measure of the shape of the distribution. So if you can imagine, it's very hard to do this kind of, you know, on radio rather than using a pen. But if you can imagine just like an income distribution, like a bump right in the middle, if the thing just sort of spreads out more to the right or the left, what you see is more people out towards the tails. And which tail really matters, as I've said. And so what you're really seeing is that the shrinking of the middle class really is just a reflection of increased income inequality, with more people up at the top doing pretty well. And that's a different kind of problem to the size. So in other words, I think it's a mistake to obsess too much about the size of the middle class rather than the condition of the middle class.
Talking to Richard Reeves, Senior Fellow in Economic Studies, Director of the Future of the Middle Class Initiative at the Brookings Institution, talking about the middle class and what the economy is doing when it comes to the middle class and who they are to begin with. Richard, some of the definitions I know are based on household income. And thinking about the quality and conditions of the middle class, maybe there was somebody who worked in a factory 20 years ago and they made $50,000, $60,000 a year. Now maybe there's a single earner. Now it's a double earner. They've cobbled together enough part-time jobs. They're making exactly the same amount of money. They'd still show up at the same place on the chart. Something's very different, though. Do we have good measures for that?
Well, we don't have great measures for that, but you're onto something really important there, which is a few things. One is that kind of how much money is coming in needs to first of all be adjusted for like how hard are you having to work to get that money. So I think your kind of point is someone making the same amount in 80 hours a week is having a very different life to someone making it in 40 hours a week. But I think even more importantly is the fact that one of the things that's actually sustained middle class incomes at all, even during this very difficult period, has been the increase in number of women working and slightly increased earnings for women in the middle of the distribution. Men's earnings have been declining for all but for people with four-year college degrees. And so if you've got declining men's earnings for kind of the majority of the population, how do households even sort of stand still? And the answer to that is by more women working and earning a little bit more than they did in the past. And so in other words, what we're seeing, I think, is both a time trade-off and a money trade-off. So basically, it looks as if for a lot of households, they're having to put more hours collectively, very often as a couple, into the labor market to sustain the same income. And so if you're interested in quality of life, you've got to think about time as well as money. And that's something that I think we're only beginning to do right now. But we do know that, for example, it's taking more and more dual-earner couples to sustain a middle-class income that used to be the case in the past. Now, that's for both good reasons about rising gender equality and rising women's wages, and for bad reasons, which is, you know, I don't think you have to be a kind of massive, an anti-feminist to think that falling male wages is just a bad thing, full stop. And that's what we're seeing for the majority of men now.
Now, Richard, if I was going to run for office, and I'm not, but if I was, I would probably promise to help the middle class. Mm-hmm. Seems like a pretty safe bet. They vote.
Yeah.
If I wanted to actually enact policies that help the middle class, yeah, what kind of things do you think I should look at?
Well, you're right. Your starting point is right, of course. I mean, I'm still, you know, one day a politician's going to come out and say, you know what, I'm not so sure the middle class matters all that much. And that would be a great moment politically. But no, you're right. Of course, the question is always, you have to follow and say, well, so who do you mean by that? And try and sort of pin them down. But so when we're talking about the middle class, on kind of almost any definition, you're talking about people who they're kind of between welfare and wealth, if you like. So they're in the labor market. They're not relying on welfare. They have wages coming in. But they certainly don't have much by way of assets or wealth kind of saving. So they kind of are, you know, this kind of living paycheck to paycheck cliche is broadly true for this kind of group. And so if we want to help them out, then there's a couple of ways you can do that. One is just through the labor market, is by increasing the amount of, you know, wages they're taking home, by increasing training and skills and so on. But we've been saying that for a long time. And I think that the more direct approach is now, which has a lot of support, is increase things like the earned income tax credit, which is a way that we essentially top up the wages of those who are kind of lower paid. And I think extend that up the distribution and give more workers a top up to their pay, because their pay's just not keeping up with economic growth. And the second thing I think we can do is provide more services, which are really valuable to middle class workers, through education, transport, and health and so on, in a sense to kind of make money matter a little bit less by providing more in terms of public goods. So those are the sorts of things that I'd be looking for people to do, is like directly helping out through some of those transfers, tax credits to working middle class Americans. And then secondly, to kind of say, okay, but what about the services that they need as well, through infrastructure investments, education, and so on. Those are the two big policy levers that I think you can pull.
Yeah, focusing on education for a moment, I think in the past we might have thought, okay, a middle-class family probably is going to be able to send their kids to school. Might be some belt tightening, but it's doable. And now it looks like a really major investment where somebody's going to take on a lot of debt, maybe lifelong debt. Are there things like that that cost a lot that make the middle-class income look less income-y?
Yeah, it's a great question because, of course, when we think about sort of, you know, what's a good income, well, it really critically depends on how much you have to spend to get the things that you want in life, right? I mean, if everything was free, nobody would be poor. And so when we're assessing quality of life and how people are doing, it's not just how much money is coming in, but how much money is going out. And we have seen that the cost of things like higher education, especially, and healthcare have risen faster than the cost of other things. And so if you think about education particularly as kind of like an opportunity good, it's something that you buy in order to, you know, buy in kind of future opportunity, especially for your kids, then the rise in the cost of college is important. Anything that can kind of bear down on those costs is going to disproportionately help middle-class kids. I do think the debate about the cost of college is a bit skewed to the upper middle class, towards the kind of real expensive colleges. And so I think that can distract from the fact that, you know, the most overwhelming majority of American kids who go to college go either to their local community college or to a four-year public. That's where they go. They're not going to really expensive private 4 years, by and large. And so actually, when we think about college costs, we need to think about the investment in public education and especially community colleges. I mean, community colleges are the most frequent, the most common destination for middle-class American kids. And so the investment in community colleges is where the debate needs to take place. But I think quite often, maybe partly because it's, you know, people who do have college degrees whose kids are going to expensive four-year colleges, it tends to be a bit obsessed with the really high sticker prices of expensive privates. And that's not really an issue for middle-class Americans. It's an issue for upper-middle-class Americans. And frankly, they can afford it. I'm not too worried about them. I'm worried about the kid that wants to get a good degree from their local community college and or their four-year public. And their public investment really does matter.
We're talking to Richard Reeves, director of the Future of the Middle Class Initiative at the Brookings Institution, looking at the health, the economic well-being of the middle class, however we define that, here in the United States. Richard, a lot of political theory looks at the value of having a strong and sizable middle class in a society to be kind of a middle ground in politics, so it's not rich versus poor. Do you see that? Is this something you're worried about in modern American politics?
Yeah, I'm worried about the way that the middle class, on any definition, is being left behind by the folks at the top and not supported that much by the kind of welfare institutions that help those at the bottom. And so you do see this much kind of much slower growth for those in the middle. And I think that does kind of cause a problem because if those who are broadly in the middle, they're working, but they're not wealthy, as we've said, don't feel as if they're sharing fairly in the proceeds of the economic growth that is taking place, then I think that that can cause significant political problems because they're a significant voting bloc, and that group really does matter for the stability of societies. It's quite hard to get a kind of causal effect. So it's quite hard to know kind of what level of inequality would you need to see, how badly would the middle class need to be doing for it to kind of cause these problems politically, but I think it's pretty clear that it can. And so it's not just an economic problem that we have to think about here, but the related potential political problem, which is if there are people who feel, not unreasonably, like life isn't getting better at the speed I kind of need it to, then where do they go with that anger? And I think that can cause real problems.
You have looked at how income growth has broken down among, I think it's five different sections, lowest to highest in the United States. What have you seen over the last couple few decades?
Yeah, so if you're really boring, you call them quintiles, Rob. That's right, the quintiles of each equal fifths of the distribution. And what you see, I mean, again, it depends on how you measure it. But it's interesting to see that for the people at the kind of in the top 20% over the last two, three decades have seen income growth of 80%+. And those at the top, top 1% have seen it even higher than that. But interesting is we've seen similar levels of growth in income for those in the bottom 20%. If we include in income things like the cost of the healthcare that we're providing to people through Medicaid and so on, and all the transfer payments, at similar levels of growth as you see at the top, and only half as fast growth, around 40% income growth for those in the middle three quintiles. And so if you kind of imagine what you're seeing is in terms of the rate of growth, you're seeing similar rates of growth on those definitions at the bottom and at the top, but much slower growth in the middle. And so whilst you can sort of talk about hollowing out in terms of size, I think it's more interesting in a way to sort of look at those income trends. But it's pretty clear and uncontested, I think, that income growth is much slower in the middle of the distribution right now. And I think we're seeing some of the consequences of that playing out.
Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Mark on the line in Richland Center. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, a couple of things. I'm actually not from Richland Center, but I am right now I've been doing this since about midnight tonight. I'm delivering papers. And I'm a retired university professor from a major land-grant institution. Now, what's bothering me is I'm making twice as much money. I'm actually making more money now as a paperboy than I did as a professor a few years back. And after I retired, I went and got a teaching degree so that I could get a teaching license and get a job as a full-time teacher in the public schools. And, well, you know what? I'm making twice as much money as a starting public teacher in Wisconsin. It seems really weird, right? Now,
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. I want to bring in our guests. So jobs we might think of as being middle class, not maybe as lucrative, and not providing retirement security in Mark's case, it sounds like.
Yeah, it does sound like that. I mean, so, look, something's gone profoundly wrong when paperboys make more than professors, as he put it there. But, you know, I don't think it's because people delivering papers are being, you know, paid Wall Street salaries. So I think what he's speaking to is it's certainly compared to the overall economic growth, a gradual corrosion in the value of salaries in the public sector. You know, people in the public sector, teachers, professors, actually, on average, seeing their incomes growing less quickly. And so that does cause a problem because those public jobs are very often kind of a bedrock of a middle class. You know, no one's typically expecting to get rich by becoming a high school teacher or a land grant professor or a civil servant lurking in City Hall, right? That's not what you do in rich. But you expect to have a decent income and you expect to see that income growing quickly. But those public sector jobs have very often fallen behind the equivalent private sector jobs, which makes it harder to attract people into those jobs and keep them. And that might be the case with Mark as well. But it also means that those jobs that used to be a pretty guaranteed ticket to the middle class are much less so now. And so that's a double whammy. You're both making it harder to incentivize people to do those jobs, but you're also reducing one of the important channels into the middle class, which used to be those public sector jobs. And so that's where public investment comes back to where we were a moment ago. Investment in public goods, not least through higher pay, is actually a middle class creating policy right now and helps to build a middle class for the future.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Richard Reeves from the Brookings Institution about the American middle class. Back to your calls. Brian is with us in Burlington. Brian, hi.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Brian?
Well, I was listening to your conversation. I'm just about ready to wrap up my day, and I thought I would share a little bit about, from my perspective of my world, where I was actually in the building trades for a good 20 years before the crash. And when that occurred, I left the building trades, but just in the last few years, I re-entered the trades, but not so much in what I used to do, but now I'm doing property management. And I have kind of like a dual, I guess you could say, perspective on that. First, like from my own personal life, it's been now about 11 years since I lost my job in 2008 when I was working for a national lumberyard. It's taken that long just to get to where my income is pretty close to what it used to be, but for myself, as far as my income compared to cost of living, I think cost of living is far outstripped from what I'm making now. So,
Brian, I'm going to jump in because we don't have too much time left. Richard, Brian's not alone. People saw big income hits in the Great Recession, and at least some, like Brian, are just now getting back to where they were.
Yeah, so I mean, the Great Recession, clearly, it was just a massive shock to the system for lots of people. And actually, it hit certain places much harder than others. And it hit the middle income folks hardest of all in those places. So the hardest hit places were the places where the middle got hit the hardest, too. And so it was a real kind of double whammy. But I think there's a broader point here, too, which is one of the things that we probably hope for and expect is that during the course of our working life, so from the age of, say, 25 to 45 or 50, or from 30 to 50 or something, that we will see our incomes grow and hopefully in a fairly sustained and predictable way, that's becoming less true. And so it's becoming more the case that you're seeing like a downward shock. And it might be followed by, so you have good years and bad years and so on. So you're getting more volatility. And so the idea that you can just predictably expect your income to grow during your own lifetime is becoming harder and harder. You're seeing fewer people moving up during their working life. And I think kind of Brian's an example of that. So it might go down and up again and so on. And I think that does a couple of things. One is it might reduce the amount of income you have overall, even on average. But more importantly, I think it makes it harder to plan and it makes it harder to feel secure. And so when we talk about income, when we talk about wages, we shouldn't just talk about levels. We should talk about stability and security as well. And I think the loss of security that was clearly highlighted by the recession actually long predates it. We're seeing more volatility, we're seeing more movement and less predictable upward movement of people's wages. And I think psychologically, a lot of us compare where we are today to where we were 5 years ago, and we look forward to 5-10 years from now and hope that we're in a better place. And if the labor market stops doing that, especially for middle class workers, then I think that can cause quite a lot of concern and insecurity. So I think Brian's really onto something, which is like he's comparing his own himself to himself at different points in time. And I think that's a very important comparison too.
Richard, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Richard Reeves, Senior Fellow at Economic Studies and Director of the Future of the Middle Class Initiative at the Brookings Institution. He was with us to talk about why we should be looking at more than just the size of the American middle class if we want to understand how it's doing, how the economy's doing as a whole. Coming up after the news, colleges and universities are relying more and more on part-time and limited-term instructors instead of tenured faculty. Our guest coming up says that's bad for students. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Recent strikes and near strikes are shining a light on an emerging issue in higher education, a growing reliance on adjunct faculty. According to 2016 data from the American Association of University Professors, 73% of instructors at the country's colleges and universities are working in non-tenure track jobs. Our next guest says that's a big problem, and if left unchanged, it could have serious implications for the future of higher education. Aaron Hanlon is an assistant professor of English at Colby College. His recent piece at the Chronicle of Higher Education is titled, "The University is a Ticking Time Bomb." Aaron, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, spell out for us just how much this has changed at universities and colleges, this shifting from relying on what we might think of, the tenured faculty professor, to other things, part-timers, short-term educators, and others.
Well, just by the numbers, it's a pretty staggering transformation, which is well documented in Benjamin Ginsberg's book, The Fall of the Faculty, which was published in 2011. Between 1975 and 2005, the percentage of administrative ranks grew by about 85%. The percentage of administrative and support staff for those administrators grew by a staggering 240%. And over that same period of time, the percentage of faculty grew by only about 51%. And what this means is that students have a less stable group of faculty to turn to for all the various functions that we have in our job.
And you write that institutions of higher education today operate as if they have no future. What do you mean by that?
Well, in so many cases, the faculty who are working what we call off the tenure track, meaning that they'll never have the possibility of tenure or a permanent position and can be terminated more or less at any time at the end of any given semester or year. These faculty are working often on a year-to-year contract, in many cases on a semester-to-semester contract. This is three-quarters of all people you would call professors at U.S. higher education institutions. And that means that the jobs themselves literally have no future. And in that case, it's very difficult, I would argue even really impossible, to think about what the future can be of teaching and learning, both in one's given field and on the academic side of the university at large.
So the question has got to be, why are institutions of higher learning turning more to these adjunct faculty, these part-timers, and limited-term employees to teach? Is it cost savings?
That's often the argument, although there have been studies fairly recently, 2017, a couple of studies by the American Institutes of Research, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit social science research institute, that have found that the cost of college does not go down when adjunctification or the conversion of the professoriate into a kind of contingent and disposable labor force goes up. So adjunctification doesn't actually save tuition costs. It doesn't actually save institutions money. What I think is behind the shift in many cases is simply the ability to have a more pliable workforce, a workforce that can be more easily controlled. But also, I think this is a wider trend in labor markets beyond academia. Casualization in general has been a trend.
Now, for a lot of people not in higher education, the tenure concept seems a little different. It's different than most people's work experience. Why in academia do you see it as important to have those tenured faculty and lots of them with that more or less guarantee that they're there for the long haul?
The main argument for it is what people often will refer to as academic freedom, which basically means that faculty and students need to be free to pursue avenues of study, avenues of research and inquiry, basically following where the evidence goes. And that anytime you have the possibility that your job can be held over your head, if you are to do some controversial research, say on climate change, or to do some research on race and ethnicity, for example, or gender, that if you can be effectively terminated on a year-to-year basis or in any given year, that you might not be as free to pursue that research and as free to get things right, ultimately. So that's the main argument.
Talking to Aaron Hanlon from Colby College. His recent piece for the Chronicle of Higher Education is "The University is a Ticking Time Bomb," looking at the increasing reliance on part-time or limited-term instructors, educators, lecturers, instead of tenured long-term faculty. Aaron, let's talk more about the consequences. Just now you were talking about the research, and you write that you worry that there is a loss of public good, potentially, if we don't have those researchers in place, not just educating, but expanding the boundaries of knowledge. What kind of concerns do you have here?
Well, I think if we don't have a somewhat stable employment future, just at the level of faculty jobs, then we also don't have the ability to retain people who are coming up through the pipeline, who are spending years and years learning and training to be professors. That's both a loss at the level of research and of what I'm calling knowledge, but also in terms of the classroom, in terms of teaching. And when you don't have a place to put all of these people who are pursuing knowledge work, it becomes harder to see how some fields might sustain themselves. Now, people could easily make the argument, and I'm sympathetic to it, that maybe we need fewer people in certain fields. It's often an argument made about my field, literary studies, and I don't agree with it. But the risk that we run when we say, oh, these people aren't really useful anyway, we don't need them, is that we're not really historically very good at predicting the future of our needs. So it might have been really easy to eliminate virology programs in the 70s after a lot of major illnesses were effectively cured by vaccines until AIDS and HIV struck. And suddenly universities didn't often have the research infrastructure to address that problem as swiftly as it might. Same thing you could say for Arabic language and history and culture programs and Middle Eastern studies before and after 9/11. So we're not too good always at predicting what we'll need. And I think it's important for there to be always a kind of stable foundation to build the future of knowledge in our different fields.
And you've mentioned a couple times concerns about the quality of the education that students receive at a college or a university. And while you say, you know, maybe that part-time lecturer is a perfectly good instructor, there's something different between having somebody who's there from year to year versus somebody who's scrambling to put together three jobs maybe at different institutions?
Absolutely. So in many cases, people working what's called part-time, which I think is a misnomer, people, in other words, who are working on a course-by-course basis and getting paid by course without retirement or insurance benefits. Faculty in that situation are often, that's about 50% of the 75% overall faculty who are working off the tenure track. Faculty in that situation often don't even have an office that they can use to meet students. They often don't have access to certain research and teaching and career development resources that make them better or that can give them some parity with respect to their tenured and tenure track colleagues in terms of improving themselves and growing in their own research and growing in the profession. And this ultimately is a problem. This ultimately is a problem for students. What it comes down to is students don't have people who are as accessible as they ought to be in this job. They don't have people who they can rely on for letters of recommendation on a longer term basis, and they don't have access to people who they can build a longer term relationship with over their 2 or 4 years, whatever the case may be, of higher education.
So, Aaron, this is a long term trend. Is there a fix for it that you can see?
I think what's going to happen, and I don't know if it's going to fix things, but I think we're going to see more organization of labor, more strikes, more collective action, and also more visibility as this issue comes to a head. I think it's absolute madness that we have had this situation for so long and not been able to do a whole lot about it. And I think sometimes scarcity of academic jobs, of funding, and so on, is going to apply more and more pressure. And I think we're going to see people who might have sat back and thought, "Oh, things are going to be fine. We're going to come out of this at some point." I think some of those people are going to start thinking more deliberately about what they can do to make sure that we have a future for higher education and for our students.
And Aaron, briefly, as we wrap up, since you've put this piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education, have you gotten a big response for it? Are you hearing from people around the country saying, yeah, we see this as a problem too?
Absolutely. And one of the most, in addition to the responses I expect, which is kind of solidarity from my faculty colleagues and non-tenure track colleagues, one of the best kinds of responses that I've gotten, one that makes me most hopeful, is parents and students getting in touch with me and saying, "I had no idea that my professors were working under these conditions. I had no idea that this was the scale of it, and I never would have known to ask about it, but I do now." And I think that's going to be a huge part of the solution too, that parents and students need to do a little bit of research along with the other research that they do when they're looking into making choices for college, and think about, are these professors who are going to be teaching me for my time at this college likely to be there for my time at this college and likely to be there with the resources that will make them be able to perform their job optimally, which ultimately redounds to me as a student.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad that you're taking on this issue.
Aaron Hanlon is an assistant professor of English at Colby College. His recent piece at the Chronicle of Higher Education is headlined, "The University is a Ticking Time Bomb." You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farad. Democratic lawmakers met with President Trump today to talk about infrastructure, and they agreed on a plan to spend $2 trillion. Here's Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi talking to reporters about their priorities after the meeting.
It's about jobs, jobs, jobs. It's about promoting commerce. It's about clean air, clean water. It's therefore a public health issue. It's a quality of life issue, getting people out of their cars, not being on the road so much. And in every way, it's a safety issue.
Not a lot of specifics so far, and that's something our next guest says is part of the problem when elected officials and the media talk about infrastructure. Beth Osborne is the director of Transportation for America, an organization that advocates on transportation and infrastructure issues. She's served as the deputy assistant secretary and the acting assistant secretary for transportation policy in the U.S. Department of Transportation. Beth, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we see in the news this big White House meeting on infrastructure. We're seeing numbers with dollar signs thrown around. You were writing on Twitter just earlier today, we're missing a big part of the story. What kind of things do you think we should be talking about when we're talking about infrastructure?
It's a really important question. You know, what are we going to get from the spending that we're discussing? We like to dive right into how much money is going to go in and out the door. But that does not tell us what we will accomplish with that spending. So we as an organization like to look at how current money is being spent as an indication of how more money would be spent. So one question is, the money that we're spending today, is that going to repair? Are we making progress in repair? Are we putting the majority of our money to repair? What's happening? Before we talk about huge increases in money, I would like to know if we're getting the results we want from the money we're spending now. And then if we're going to put new money in, we should know whether or not the money we're spending now is getting us what we want and whether or not tweaks need to be made to the program to get us more of what we want. But all the discussion of for the 20 years of my career have been around just how much money goes in and out with no conversation about what will be accomplished for that spending.
Why do you think that is? I mean, is it politically more fun to say, hey, we're building roads, here's a large sum of money that we're doing, than, okay, here is our 10-year plan to maintain this road that already exists? Does that just feel more boring for politicians and us in the media?
I think there are two things. One is there's not a lot of knowledge of how the transportation program works. It's not part of the annual spending process. It's a trust-funded program that kind of runs on its own over six-year cycles. And as a result, we don't have a regular conversation about how much money should go in and what we're getting for it and what's considered good and bad. And that leaves us in just a place of whether or not it's self-sustaining. And it can be self-sustaining and doing good things or self-sustaining and doing bad things. So we need to dig a little bit deeper and get a little more knowledge on what the program does. I think the other thing when it comes to repair is it just is not very sexy. The fact of the matter is if you build something new, you get a ribbon cutting and a lot of plaudits, and it's exciting. You're giving people something new. But if you rebuild something that's existing, one, there's the inconvenience of the building process, and you get hammered in the press, quite frankly, for all the traffic backup that comes around the maintenance. And then at the end, all you've done is re-delivered the thing people already had, which is not something that tends to result in great congratulations. So if the program forces people to do the responsible thing, which is repair, there's always going to be a political push to do the new shiny thing instead.
Well, does it happen, and have you seen it happen over times, that we put lots of money into that shiny new project, and that happens ultimately at the expense of needed repairs and maintenance for existing roads and highways?
Absolutely. We've done a report over the last 8 years. We've done two in the past, and we're going to do another one in a couple of weeks, in fact, looking at the condition of roadways. And a little preview is they're not getting better. So we're spending a lot of money, but they're not getting better.
Talking to Beth.
So we need to look and figure out why that is.
We're talking to Beth Osborne, Director of Transportation for America, looking at infrastructure spending at the federal level, what works and what doesn't work. Beth, let's look at the positive side for a little bit. Can you point toward a type of project, maybe even a particular project if you want, where you think the feds got the priorities right, local stakeholders were on board, and it was a successful project?
Sure. I mean, a lot of our program the funding comes from the feds, but the decisions are all made at the state level and some a little bit at the local level, but mostly at the state level. The feds don't really direct any dollars to particular projects. And I think that's something that a lot of people, including, frankly, members of Congress, fail to understand. When I was at USDOT, I ran a program then known as the Tiger Program, now known as the Build Program, where the feds and locals and states collaborated on projects that had great support at all levels of government, that really focused on the benefits first. What are we going to accomplish for this spending, and whether or not we're accomplishing greater benefits than the cost of the project? And I think that program has been quite successful. It also is the most popular program at the U.S. Department of Transportation. So we can orient ourselves around a discussion of benefits if we so choose.
Have you seen projects in the past that are not only maybe taking away from repair of other projects, but that actually have negative consequences, that are bad infrastructure decisions?
Absolutely. A lot of what we do in transportation to go after congestion bottlenecks might benefit people that are traveling over one corridor, but they create a big blockade for the people who once were traveling locally. And we actually don't even measure what the impact of creating a barrier to short trips locally, what the cost of that is compared to the benefit of speeding up other people's trips by sometimes just a few seconds a day. We are so focused on that bottleneck, we have failed to consider what the impact on the system is. And as a result, we have cities across the country that have the same number of people, twice the infrastructure, and twice the congestion. So we as a nation have pioneered a program to move the same number of people half as fast for twice the cost.
How do we change our thinking, or maybe we've done it already, I don't know, but how do we change our thinking to make sure that we look at, I guess, all the spillover effect of a decision like that, not just, as you say, on that one artery, but on all the roads you might block off to make make way for that?
Yeah, that is the question of the day, and we definitely have not figured that out as a nation, but we do have some states and jurisdictions that have gone out ahead and started to look for better ways to measure the impact of their investments. The state of Virginia passed a law back in 2014 that requires them to measure access to jobs by all modes of travel. And they weren't sure how to do it, so they went and figured it out. And they now have a measure for all new capacity projects that looks at whether or not, or how many jobs it gives everyone access to by all modes of transportation. That means driving, transit, walking, and biking. And that methodology is now being used by other states around the nation, including Massachusetts and Washington and Hawaii and Utah and a bunch of metropolitan planning organizations. And if we were to orient around that way of looking at things, access to jobs and services, rather than whether or not one stretch of highway is moving efficiently, you're going to see a much better overall system in terms of its function.
In our last minute or so, Beth, okay, we have this big meeting, president, Democratic leaders of Congress. A number, $2 trillion is what I'm hearing. Who knows if that's what it's going to be? There's talk about how you pay for that, whatever. But if they come out with a number like that, what kind of groundwork do you hope that leaders in Washington do to make sure that whatever amount they end up spending is used effectively?
Well, I think they need to set some priorities and make clear that the top priority is safety and the second priority is repair, and that we don't get to go build additions to our homes while the roof is leaking. We have to take care of what we've already built and have a plan for managing the assets that we already created. The fact of the matter is everything we invest in is an asset, but it is also a liability. And its long-term maintenance cost is more expensive than its initial capital cost. If we're going to be responsible as a country, we're going to think about those long-term costs right up front.
Beth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on your show.
That was Beth Osborne, director of the advocacy group Transportation for America. She was with us to talk about some of the things she thinks should be part of discussions about infrastructure spending. That's as Congress and the White House have tentatively agreed to pursue a bipartisan plan on infrastructure aimed at spending $2 trillion on projects around the country. You can share your thoughts. What do you want to see the federal government do when it comes to infrastructure, highways, bridges, and more? Email ideas@WPR.org.
That is so fetch.
Gretchen, stop trying to make fetch happen. It's not going to happen.
Fetch didn't happen, but the movie sure did. Today is the 15th anniversary of the film Mean Girls. On this day in 2004, it hit the theaters and became a defining moment for many then teenagers, including J. Carlisle Larson.
Yep.
Hey.
I was a teenager then, and it was a really big movie for us.
And this is a movie that you watch to this very day.
Oh, yeah. If it's on TV, I'll watch it. If I'm just having like a down day, I will watch Mean Girls.
Now, what is it that struck you and so many other people of your generation? This is a little late for me. I've watched it a couple times. But what is it that just struck such a nerve?
Well, if I can speak for all mid-millennials.
And you can.
I am. I will do that. I'll take on that yoke.
The voice of your generation.
it was just very funny at the time. And sure, looking back on it now, some of the things are, you know, a little bit iffy. But it was funny. A lot of really strong lady characters in particular, dealing with some stuff that you dealt with in high school, which is some backstabbing at times. So seeing it kind of on the screen in a non-Heather's capacity was kind of fun.
When you watch, is it mainly just nostalgia or do you still laugh out loud?
Some parts I really do laugh out loud still, which I don't know what that says about me and my movie watching, but I do still enjoy the movie.
Thanks, JC. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.